The ice of spring.
You can't predict where they're going to form or exactly when they're going to form, and when they do, causes water to rise real quickly sometimes, and you can't forecast when they're going to break either.
Like the spring in a nasty trap, the National Weather Service says communities along the Missouri and Red Rivers can only hope they can keep ice jams from compounding already record flooding. When spring break is more like a disaster, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Yes, spring break is all about river ice up there in the Northern Prairie. It's Thursday, March 26th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora is out spending time with her new baby. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about the status of the Obama budget as it faces some red pens in Congress. We'll also talk to some North Dakotans who find out how they're trying to prevent the rising waters with sandbags. And we'll talk with the head of the Texas State Board of Education, who's questioning how evolution should be taught in schools. First, some headlines. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner wants to add to his regulation toolbox. He says it's missing the hammer, and he needs to bang out some new rules for non-bank entities like AIG.
We came into this financial crisis as a country without the authority and without the tools we needed to contain the damage to the economy.
Speaking of damage, a couple major economic indicators are expected in about 30 minutes. We'll learn the final estimate of the GDP from the fourth quarter. We'll learn the damage. Last time the Commerce Department said it fell at an annual rate of 6.2%. There's a revision downward that's expected by economists. But we'll learn how many people applied for new unemployment benefits as well last week. Mark Garrison, what did I miss?
Thank you, John. U.S. intelligence officials say North Korea has moved a rocket onto a launch pad. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is speaking out against it. She says North Korea has already been warned against firing any kind of missile.
This provocative action in violation of the United Nations mandate will not go unnoticed, and there will be consequences.
North Korea is widely suspected of preparing a long-range missile test. It claims it's only preparing to test a satellite. IBM plans to eliminate 5,000 U.S. jobs. That's about 4% of its total American workforce. A company manager says the cuts will be primarily in the services division. A legendary historian of the black experience in America has died at the age of 94. John Hope Franklin passed away yesterday. He contributed research to the Supreme Court case of Brown versus Board of Education that, of course, ended racial segregation in schools. He was also the first black president of the American Historical Association. The President Obama's choice to be the next ambassador to Afghanistan has his confirmation hearing today. Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry was once the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. He says he'll retire from the Army if confirmed. He's believed to be the first active duty general or admiral nominated for an ambassadorship.
You know, just the John Hope Franklin life, they're 94 years from a period of extreme segregation to the first African-American president.
He lived it as well as shared it.
An amazing historian and academically an amazing moment. So we're talking about the market. Of course, the Dow opens today at 7750. Futures suggest it's going to be a positive opening. We're looking at hero stories from the recession. You have any?
I have had somebody that sort of saved me from the recession. It's my father, and he's putting me back to school.
Sandbagging along the river of the recession. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The Dow futures are up. It looks like a positive trading session at the beginning when the stock market opens at 9:30. Femi Oke is out all this week looking for stories of heroes in the recession. We think of the recession as kind of a flood of economic bad news. And looking at the pictures of what's going on up in Fargo, North Dakota, are you finding sandbaggers along this river of bad news who maybe have helped you during these times? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Femi has found some great stories she's going to share with us later in the week, and we want to hear your stories. 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. Recession heroes have helped you. Democrats are advancing a retooled version of President Obama's budget this week. And the question is, what do you keep your eye on? The huge number, $3.6 trillion in the 2010 budget? Or is it more the vision thing? What are the policy implications in this blueprint? Well, here to sort through it all, and he has been sitting through all of it, is our very own Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning, John.
Now, you know, Todd, I don't have time to listen. You know, I do get C-SPAN on the television, but I don't have time to listen to the entire debate about this budget. And I do know some of the numbers, and we can talk about the fiery sort of debating points in the House and the Senate. But you've actually sat through the whole thing. Can you give me a sort of feel for, what's coming up, the language that's being used, the tone of the whole thing?
Yeah, let's just start off. Yesterday was the full day of markup in the House Budget Committee. It went over 13 hours.
Wow.
And I know, John, that maybe you don't have the stamina.
I don't.
Or even perhaps the will.
Correct.
To sit through a House Budget Committee markup. But
you, that's here, where you come in.
Here at The Takeaway, we sit through markups, so you don't have to. So I put together a little something, John, really with you in mind, because I know you don't have the guts or the stamina to do this.
Guts.
I put together. You want to know this? You want to know the tone of a budget markup?
Yes.
Give a listen to this.
The committee first will consider the document containing the budget aggregates, functional categories, and other matters.
Lays it all out. Here it is. The numbers are not pretty.
$36 trillion unfunded liability.
$1 trillion a year.
At least $646 billion is probably more than that.
This isn't even European economics. This really isn't even economics.
We have a lot of money at stake. We're talking about $240 billion.
This is not worthy of support for $240 billion.
$320 million.
It's going to create an accounting nightmare.
Can I have chart 13, please?
I mean, at what point do you say enough's enough?
Yes, at what point do you say enough is enough? I would say to my friend, I think for most Americans, it came on November 6th of 2008.
You see what I'm
enough
willing
is
to
enough.
Endure?
Yes.
So between 13 and 14 hours condensed down to, I think the engineer said, 46 seconds.
But it seems just from listening to that, and I do have the guts to listen to 46 seconds of that, it seems as though the size of this budget has handed the Republicans an issue, and Democrats are struggling to pick out which issues they want to really stand behind in Barack Obama's agenda, which is what this budget is really about.
Well, this is really what budgets are always about. The budget process every year is almost perennially partisan. White House budgets and majority party budgets are never a bipartisan exercise because it's about ideas. And aside from the numbers that you heard in that cute little montage, you also heard grand ideas about philosophy and about party politics. When does all this end? Well, the voters said it ended November 6th of 2008. That's what budgets are about, the big ideas of the White House and the big ideas of the party. Don't expect any Republicans to sign on to this. This is the major wedge between them, and they use it, both sides, to define what they're about. The Republicans say over and over and over again, trust me, this spends too much and borrows too much. Obama says, yes, it's borrowing a lot and spending now. We are repairing the damage from years of Republican rule and the war and all of the spending and borrowing that President Bush did in the Republican Congress, and we're trying to make the economy healthy so that this doesn't happen again in the long term. This is about the long term. Stay focused on the long term. So those are the big ideas that are clashing, and near the twain shall meet, I don't think.
Well, it seems here's Republican Senator Judd Gregg, Republican from New Hampshire, who seems to be very, very concerned about procedure and not so concerned about the deficit. It's as though he wants to stand in the way and that somehow that's a responsible view here. Judd Gregg has gotten a lot of attention in his opposition to the Obama budget. What do you make of this statement here, Todd?
What you're suggesting here, however, is a rewrite of the entire health care system as it affects everyone in this country. 17% of our gross national product will be affected by this. Everybody will be affected by this and allow no amendments in the Senate and have 20 hours of debate.
Now, you know, it sort of sounds to me like a rewrite of the entire health care system. Wow, great. That sounds pretty good. I mean, I don't want it to be too expensive, but somehow the procedure, the fact that we're going to do this quickly is outrageous,
right,
to Senator Gregg. I don't quite get that.
Right. Well, the budget process is murkier, and Greg is talking about a part of the budget process that's even murkier than murky. And I'll explain it quickly if I can. It's procedural, but it's important. There's a thing in the budget process called reconciliation instructions. It's just one or two little lines of legislative prose. It's not much, but it basically allows you to, once the policy comes out that fits with all this, not in the budget, but later on in the year when they do health care, it's a way that lets you pass the legislation in the Senate with only 50 votes, no filibuster, and no amendments. Now, that's important. That's important because the whole point of the Senate is you need 60 votes. You need bipartisan buy-in, especially on the big things, right? Healthcare affects all of us across the country and, by the way, 17% of the economy and rising. Now, in the Senate, this is an anathema. You don't use this little trick. It's basically a trick, let's be honest.
It puts off the hard questions. It puts off the hard questions, right?
It does. You don't use this little trick for big items like this. It's just not done. And the Senate Democrats say, we agree. We don't want to use this. It's not appropriate. But guess where it is getting slipped in? In the House, where they don't even need reconciliation. They have no use for it procedurally. But the House does have it in its bill. And what Greg is worried about, that when this gets to conference and comes back to the Senate, even though the Senate never passed these tricky instructions, it'll be in there. Huh. It'll be slipped in there. And then later on when they do health care or they do big numbers on education or maybe big numbers on cap and trade, possibly environment, that the Democrats will only need 50 votes, a simple majority, to do major rewrites of major policy. Now, if you're a Democrat, great. You think that's a great idea. It'll be easier to do. But it doesn't portend the kind of bipartisan, broad consensus buy-in that the president has been saying he's been wanting the whole time.
Well, and you can hear the frustration on the part of some Democrats over this obsession with the procedure in this budget, when I think some, like, for instance, Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat from Iowa, would have preferred to have the debate be more about policy. Listen to this, Todd.
We're not going to put in money to help get your kids educated, to take care of your health care, to meet your community needs. I'm not going to stand for that. I mean, if we're in a crunch, the people at the top have got to kick in a little bit more.
Now, there's Senator Harkin talking to you about a frustration that, if we're going to spend, I want to do some good things, and, it's just not going to happen if we focus on this sort of crunch business.
A member of the president's own party and a liberal, Tom Harkin. And what he's saying there's – basically what happened was his Senate colleagues, the Senate Democratic budget writers, Kent Conrad, cut $14 billion from the White House request for domestic discretionary spending. Now, those are the kinds of things Harkin was talking about, health care, education, unemployment programs, things like that. And those are things that are important to Harkin. So he's upset that those kind of things got the short end of the stick in the need to save money because the deficit numbers are so big. But there's another interesting little twist about this that I want to mention quickly. Harkin believes in these things. I'm sure he believes in them down to his bones. But he also happens to be the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that handles all these things. And the bottom line there is that when they cut these things that he's upset about, they came right after his jurisdiction. They cut his jurisdiction.
Oh, right.
So he's an appropriator. He wants the freedom to spend that money. They just took it away.
So
he doesn't like it.
And again, but those are hard questions that will again be taken up when we're into the appropriations process. Quickly, can you distinguish between the House version and the Senate version? And what is the danger that at the end of the day we're going to be left with a kind of a status quo budget with a high deficit and no real progress on the big issues that Barack Obama talked about?
I think the chances are very low that you'll be left with a status quo budget because we're not in a status quo situation economically. Mm-hmm. That CBO number that you heard about with, what was it, $2.5 trillion extra on the deficit over 10 years, there's not a lot of status – there's not a ton of status quo in either of these budgets. They both leave room, even though not quite in the way Obama wanted, they leave room for the big things later on this year, big things on health care, big things on environment, potentially big things on education.
And one of those
not
big
the way
things,
Obama wanted one of
those,
all in there.
One of those big things is the deficit. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much for putting that in context for us.
Always a pleasure.
Oh, no. For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
Go, Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Chilly and wet. Those are the pictures from North Dakota, Fargo, where they're looking at a number 41. That's where the Red River is expected to crest by Saturday, 41 feet. It's a huge record, and it's been revised upward. Joining us now to talk about the flooding in the community of Fargo and, in general, the problems in the prairie region around North Dakota, where they're battling both rising waters and ice jams, is Todd McDonald, reporter for Prairie Public Broadcasting. He joins us from Fargo. Todd, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for calling.
And Donald Schwert is a professor of geology at North Dakota State University in Fargo. Professor Schwert, thanks for being with us.
Well, good morning.
Todd, let me begin with you. How is the community dealing with this situation? And spring flooding is always an issue in Fargo, but why is it so different this time around? And I'm wondering if things have changed in the last 10, 15 years in your community.
Why has it changed? We have received, just a good deal of snow. It's been what they, the catchphrase is the perfect storm. And we've been seeing that throughout the winter, large winter storms coming in. We don't have as much snow, didn't have as much snow as the winter of 97, where we saw our last record flood. But late in the season, we saw not only a quick warming, we also saw rain, and another winter blizzard kind of came in and capped off everything and kind of set us on that track for flood preparations.
So, Professor Schwert, the erratic qualities of the weather actually contribute to the flooding problems above and beyond simply the proliferation of water, right?
That's right. We sit on a valley that that slopes to the north. And so in these northern climates, when you think about how a spring thaw works, it typically starts down in the south and works its way northward. And so that's what we have in the Red River Valley. The thaw begins in the southern portion of the valley, and then waters are released and work their way northward. And so as those waters work their way northward, they start to couple then with waters being introduced by the spring thaw itself as it's working northward. So everything couples and builds up northward as the flood progresses. And so these floods can become vast by the time they get to the northernmost part of the valley.
So the waters rise, they move north, and the temperature drops, creating a natural geologic bottleneck.
Actually, the temperature's warm.
Really?
As we go northward here with the spring thaw. And so the thaw is progressing northward, and the waters are progressing northward, and all these waters now are piling up.
Wow. You know, the very reason that North Dakota is a great agricultural region is also why it is vulnerable to flooding. Can you explain that, Professor?
Yeah. Let me reflect a little bit on it. Let's say a typical flood. So when you think of a flood on a normal river, let's say the Ohio River, the water spills out onto the floodplain, and it's confined by hills. It's confined by valley walls to either side. Well, here, we don't have hills. We don't have hills for tens of miles. Fargo sits in the middle of the bed of what was once a vast glacial lake, Glacial Lake Agassiz. It sits in the middle of one of the flattest places on Earth. And so when water spills out of the channel of the Red River, it spreads as a shallow, wide sheet of water that slowly creeps northward toward Canada. These sheets are very difficult to model hydrologically and a challenge to address through engineering.
Wow. Well, Todd, how is the community dealing with this? And I guess, you know, my first question should be, how come you aren't hanging up the phone and going out to sandbag? It seems as though everyone in Fargo is doing that this morning.
It is, yes. I know even my my middle school son went out and was out volunteering this week. They pulled eighth grade students in from the middle schools to help fill sandbags, and it's a huge community response in the Fargo-Moorhead area and from the surrounding areas. I spoke with one volunteer. They had come over on a busload of people from Bismarck, where Bismarck is having their own flooding problems, ice jams along the Missouri River, from the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul area, St. Cloud State of Minnesota. It's it really rallies the community spirit. And the days are kind of blurring right now, but on Tuesday morning, we got the report that the sandbag volunteers had filled a 500,000 sandbags that day.
All kinds of records are dropping.
It is, yeah. And, you know, this is by hand. I mean, the NDSU campus has a sports facility called the Fargo Dome, and they had set up a sandbag station outside of it. And when it started raining, the coach of the football team went in. They talked with the dome director, and they said, let's pull the AstroTurf off the field and set up the sandbag station inside. We'll keep people dry. We'll keep production going. So this dome is now a new sandbag central, and it's just amazing how the response that we're seeing.
Todd, you know, in the midst of nobody wants a flood, and the president has declared the entire state a disaster area, but mm-hmm. is there something welcome about this sense of community spirit in dealing with this flood at this point of such uncertainty throughout the country?
That's an interesting question, because North Dakota has been insulated from
That's right.
a lot of the financial problems that this nation is seeing. I mean, our unemployment rate is still very good. I think we're like 4%. It's we're still in single digits. Our energy sector has been performing so well. I mean, we've just been very insulated. Agricultural prices had been good despite the high energy costs, so, you know, for fuel and input. So we're actually we're kind of the exception to the rule when it comes to the national economy right now.
So if you can just get through this spring, North Dakota will be fine. Todd McDonald, thanks so much for helping us to understand what your community is going through there near the Fargo Dome. Todd, thanks for joining us.
You're certainly welcome.
Todd McDonald's a reporter for Prairie Public Broadcasting. We also heard from Professor Donald Schwert, professor of geology at North Dakota State University in Fargo. Thanks to you, Professor. And Mark Garrison has more headlines now.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, the Treasury Secretary is back on Capitol Hill today. Tim Geithner will outline plans to reform the nation's financial system. He's testifying in the House in about 90 minutes. His proposal is expected to allow the government to take over financial institutions other than banks, like troubled insurance giant AIG or hedge funds, things like that. Geithner says more authority over financial companies would help the government avoid future economic collapses.
We're moving now to ensure that we're equipped both in the future and as soon as possible with a more modern framework of regulation to, again, leave us less vulnerable to these kind of things in the future.
Another apparent idea in the Obama administration plan is creating a mechanism to look over the overall health of the financial system rather than different agencies focusing on different parts. Some 80,000 people have sent in questions to President Obama. He's holding a town hall style meeting with questions submitted from the public online. If you want to play along, you can send in a question or vote on the ones you like for about another hour at whitehouse.gov. The president will answer questions later on this morning. A new investigation finds most food companies don't keep records of where the raw ingredients come from and where their finished products go. The Department of Health and Human Services tried to track 40 common items, food items, but they could only follow 5 of them all the way through the food supply chain.
So all that stuff on the label is just a bunch of malarkey?
We don't know.
Great. That's reassuring. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Wall Street futures trading reacting to some positive news or not so negative news from the government. The government has revised downward the estimate of the fourth quarter GDP. It shrank by 6.3% as opposed to 6.2%. And jobless claims hit 633,000 in the latest week of reporting. So the Texas Board of Education is in the midst of a major fight this week over a new science curriculum that's designed to possibly challenge the guiding principle of evolution. The board is about to vote on standards that will govern science teaching on evolution in the state for the next decade. Joining us is the chair of the Texas State Board of Education, Don McElroy, who's leading the charge to put some of these questions into the science curriculum for the entire state of Texas. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. You stated it very accurately.
Well, thank you. Why this issue now, and given the fact that it's going to be around for the next 10 years, what are the implications for science students in your state?
Well, I think the implications are really good if we're able to challenge this idea of evolution. You know, evolution is the claim that all life is descended from common ancestors, from a common ancestor by unguided natural processes. And to me, the whole issue is we got to be honest with the kids. Is that claim really true? Does the evidence support it? And my contention is the evidence doesn't support it.
And the evidence does support a notion of creation that is what? When was the earth created, in your view?
Oh, well, we're not debating that. That's not the issue. So my personal view about that doesn't really come into play. What we're looking at, what my main concern is the evolution standard. We're not getting off into the debate about creationism or intelligent design, even though I am a creationist. I mean, I have no
– right.
I don't go around hiding that at all. I'm not ashamed. I think – frankly, that's another debate. It's another one you might could call me about, but everybody's got a problem.
Okay, that's fine. That's fair. But then why wouldn't I be concerned as a parent in Texas about someone at the center of this controversy who has personal beliefs such as your own? I might be concerned that your personal beliefs about questioning evolution are getting into this entire debate and that it's going to have implications for the next 10 years in Texas.
Okay, here's what I would say. Let's look at the data. What evidence do we have that shows that common ancestor, that we all share, all life shares a common ancestor?
Well, it's a scientific consensus. It's in the DNA of every organism. There's a fossil record that's incomplete but certainly supports the proposition.
Well, that's the problem is where do you actually see the evidence? The evidence in the fossil record. And if you go to the paleontologist back 150 years ago when Darwin wrote his book, he said the gravest objection to his theory is the fossil record. Well, in 150 years, it's still the gravest problem. In fact, it has shown that the theory is false.
If you look
at the fossil record, you do not see what Darwin predicted. Darwin spent all his time talking about the incompleteness of the fossil record.
Right. Well, incompleteness is one thing. False is another. Dr. McElroy, what paleontologist says evolution is false?
Well, they don't,
but
they do state that the evidence shows there are certain patterns in the fossil record. And the patterns that they describe in the fossil record are sudden appearance. All of a sudden, you see life suddenly appear, you know, some organism. And then through the period of time, it stays exactly the same, basically the same, and then it disappears or it's still alive. And
right. Well, that of course relates to the incompleteness.
Stephen Jay Gould is the one. That's why they came up with punctuated equilibrium, because the data didn't fit it. And so, frankly, if you look at the actual evidence in the fossil record, it still does not support the Darwin idea.
Now, are you as concerned about the incompleteness of, say, super string theory in nuclear physics as you are about this particular incompleteness in the evolutionary theory?
Of course not.
Well, then see again,
I
doctor.
I don't even understand string theory.
As a parent in Texas, doctor, just hold on a second. As a parent in Texas, then I'm concerned that you're sort of like overwhelmingly concerned about this particular aspect of science when your job is really to be concerned about the broad implications for science and all things that kids learn in Texas.
Right.
Isn't that a problem?
You know, I understand what you're asking. Now, here's the deal. This whole issue, we've been looking at this for a year and a half, and this issue has been raised by the academia far left. They're the ones, and the evolutionist ones, that have brought this issue forward. We probably weren't even going to touch this because we had language that requires students to understand the strengths and weaknesses. But that came under attack, and they don't even want to allow something as scientific as to discuss a 20-year-old policy that has raised no trouble called the Strengths and Weaknesses of Evolution. Frankly, it's not our side that has raised this issue. It has been raised by the other side, the evolutionist side.
Well, but you're in control of the Texas board here. You're directing the debate. Well, you could walk away from it tomorrow, right?
Here's the issue. What does the data show? And the data, what is the evidence for evolution?
Okay,
common ancestry. Let me finish just this part.
Okay.
Common ancestry is the first key part, that all life descend from common ancestry. You should see that in the fossil record. The fossil record does not support it. Stephen Jay Gould, who is an ardent evolutionist, had to come up with the punctuated equilibrium, but he basically had this to say about the fossil record. He says, the stasis is data. Stasis is where they stay the same. He said, stasis is data set. Times before breakfast,
right.
for a week.
Very familiar
that's
with Stephen Jay Gould. Right. Now,
right.
Stephen
okay,
Jay Gould
now,
was
then,
also, Stephen Jay Gould was actually a biologist. You're trained as a...
Oh, no, he was a paleontologist.
Paleontologist, right. You're not a paleontologist, are you?
No, but I can read what he wrote, and I can read what other evolutionists have written.
Right, but then why not let them tell the story? Why would we want a dentist who is a lively conversationalist about paleontology determining what people learn in science classes throughout the state of Texas?
Because we want to be honest with the kids. If you want to be honest with the kids, if you want kids to be able to really keep a passion for science, to be able to trust what science is, you don't sit there and pull the wool over their eyes with a lot of ideas that just don't support – are not supported by the data.
Do you think kids can't find out on their own that there are questions in the fossil record just by reading Stephen Jay Gould's work, just as you've done?
Well, why don't we just put it in the standard? And the standard is – the standard requires them to study the sufficiency or insufficiency. Let me finish the fossil record. Fossil record is awesome. It is the strongest evidence for evolution because there are patterns in the fossil record. One of the patterns is the sudden appearance, and then they stay the same, but also there's a sequential nature. And this is the strongest evidence, I believe, for evolution. So I am for teaching the fossil record because it does have evidence for it.
Well,
look at the old rocks, you have very simple organisms. When you get to these young rocks, they're more complex. So life must have changed through time. So
all right, Don, you know, we have to go, we definitely have a feel for the debate that's going on there. I guess my concern is, are the right people debating this?
Absolutely.
Well, my thanks to Dr. Don McElroy, chair of the Texas State Board of Education, debating evolution and the questions about evolution. And we've got a debate on our website.
Mr. Hockenberry, it's like I love your guys' show, but you picked a fight with your guest from Texas Education Board and really didn't allow him to explain where he was coming from. That was how it sounded to me.
The conversation about evolution in Texas was wonderful. It was nice to hear someone in the media who knows what they're talking about. You really put that guy back on his heels.
Well, what do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. The debate continues.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Dr. Timothy Spahr, you nailed it, dude.
Well, this is a big team effort. I'm not sure this is all up to me.
Well, astronomer and director of the Minor Planets Center at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, one of the astrophysicists who actually tracked an asteroid from space all the way to landing on Earth, I believe somewhere in Sudan.
Yes, that's correct.
First of all, explain the story as quickly as you can and why this is so hard to do.
Okay. In short, there are surveys all over the world that look for minor planets, and specifically they're looking for things that might hit the Earth. This object was discovered by a friend of mine, Richard Kowalski, works at the University of Arizona. He reported it as you're supposed to do when you discover something, report it to the Minor Planet Center. Our software posted it on our webpage, and when I went to update the orbit, I could tell that an impact was imminent.
And basically the impact question is a math problem, right?
Yeah, and in this case, it's actually fairly complicated computationally, but I could tell the orbits that I calculated, most of them had it hitting the Earth, and so I got a hold of the people who are the experts in that particular calculation to verify it.
What's the uncertainty? Is it the spin of this big rock that's coming towards the Earth? Is it something about the ability of telescopes to actually resolve it? What is it that makes the math problem really, really hard?
The tricky part actually just has to do with how well you can measure its location on the sky, because what we need is three-dimensional information, and you only get two-dimensional information when you're looking at something on the sky. So there's a set of equations that go to sort of trying to get you a distance to the object, and you use that as an estimate, and you iterate. So it's fairly complicated.
Now, what's it like to be all excited about, I know it's going to hit the Earth, but not really be able to answer the question, yeah, but where, dude?
We knew where it was going to hit within, you know, a few countries when we had the first orbit. So, you know, it's like, we know the general area where it is.
And so when it came down, how were you able to observe what happened? And I guess what are they called? Paleontologists are going to actually take a look at what this thing is made out of, right?
The meteorite scientists have got their pieces, and they're actually doing work on that now. I'm strictly an orbit person, so I don't know very much about the meteorites.
So the reentry was pretty exciting for you?
I stayed up to see sort of what sort of blurbs would come across the internet about it. The sad part, I guess, is that it went into the Earth's shadow about an hour before impact, so we lost it, and we were just sort of sitting there waiting, hoping that somebody would see the flash.
So no fiery colors, flash, kind of, oh, that's completely awesome.
Well, if you were in Africa, it was completely awesome.
You could have flown there.
We had a pretty short warning. You know, it was 19 hours from start to finish.
Wow.
So.
and the budget of the Minor Planet Center, I guess, is not something that you could charter a plane and go to Sudan on short notice.
No, but I will say that we did just receive full funding from NASA for 3 years, so we are all very happy here.
Well, that's terrific. Dr. Timothy Spahr, thanks so much for joining us on the program. He's astronomer and director of the Minor Planet Center, Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, one of the people who tracked an asteroid from deep space all the way to northern Africa. Thanks, doctor.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A view of the housing crisis and mortgage bubble from near the bottom. Looks pretty good if you're a buyer. We'll find out about that in a moment, right after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour. Some key economic reports just came out a few minutes ago. The economy shrank at an annual rate of 6.3% in the fourth quarter of last year. That's the government's final estimate. It's a bit worse than what they said a month ago. Another new report shows 652,000 new applications for unemployment benefits last week. That's a slight jump from the week before and a little more than what economists expected. The total number of people filing for jobless benefits is more than 5.5 million. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Mexico right now, but she spent part of her time there speaking out against a reported North Korean missile test. U.S. intelligence says North Korea has moved a rocket onto a launch pad. The country is suspected of preparing to test long-range missiles early next month. North Korea claims it's only preparing a satellite test. An Air Force F-22 fighter jet crashed yesterday in the South Carolina desert, killing a test pilot for contractor Lockheed Martin. The F-22 Raptor is the Air Force's most advanced and expensive fighter. The military says a board of officers will investigate what happened. Houston Astros shortstop Miguel Tejada is due in federal court today for sentencing. He pleaded guilty to misleading Congress about his use of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball. John?
That's a huge one.
You bet.
Thank you, Mark Garrison. And Mark gives us numbers all the time, or when Femi is here, she gives us numbers. We look at numbers a lot on this program, economics numbers, and there's been an uptick in new and existing home sales across the United States. Economists look at those numbers and say, have we reached a bottom in the housing crisis? Well, the housing bubble burst, and everything went down after that. We've been talking about this entire economic downturn as a manifestation of what was essentially a housing bubble bursting. Well, the people who are in the best position to give us a sense of what the bottom actually would look like in the housing market are real estate agents, who are suddenly looking at incentives for purchase, lower prices and available inventory in markets around the country that perhaps have never been seen, let alone seen in the lifetime of these real estate agents. And joining us are Ryan Ward, who manages a team of agents through Keller Williams called the Ryan Ward Group. He's a real estate agent in Atlanta. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ed Snively of the Ed Snively Realty Group works in El Centro, California, another important housing market. He joins us very early in the morning on a phone line. Ed, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for the courtesy of having me on.
Sure. Ed, let's say I'm a buyer of homes, okay? And forget my family's concern about getting a house in a good neighborhood or a good school. What kinds of things are available to me that would have been unthinkable even 2 years ago in terms of inventory, incentives, and, you know, all kinds of deals?
Well, I think the most important thing, and you hit it right on the head, is inventory. There are a number of homes that are out there, but added to this right now are key incentives by the federal government. If you're a first-time buyer, there's an $8,000 tax credit incentive here in California on new homes. The state of California has an additional $10,000. Now, you couple that with probably, in my opinion, the most important ingredient, interest rates down in the 4 category. That is sparking interest, getting our phones to ring, and we are showing property.
And indeed, the numbers are reflecting that. In the West, the rise in new home sales was 6.6%. Ryan Ward, aside from the federal incentives, what sorts of things are sellers putting into their deals to really spark purchasers in your neck of the woods?
Well, at the local level, we're seeing a lot of the builders who have had the hardest time keeping up with the reduction in prices that we've seen for resale homes offering a lot of incentives in way of buy downs of interest rates to get people in to make the homes more affordable on the new construction side. That's really outside of what the federal government is doing. Is the builders themselves are trying, you know, anything that they can do to get buyers back in the market. The resale home values have continued to drop, making them really more affordable than they have been in a number of years. I think our prices here are down to 1998 levels. I mean, that represents an extremely good value for buyers just overall.
You know, it seems as though the psychology of the market has absolutely turned 180 degrees, and I wonder if both of you could comment on this. When I was a buyer, you know, quite a while ago, the issue was, well, you know, there aren't many houses on the market, but the one thing you can count on is that the price is going to appreciate and that you'll be able to deduct your mortgage interest. Now, Ed, you're talking about I can deduct my down payment, I can deduct my mortgage interest, I've got prices lower than they've been in a long time, I've got a million houses to choose from. The only thing I can't count on is the price of my house appreciating. Is that a good trade-off in your view, Ed?
Well, I think you can count on it appreciating. I think values have come back down. Ryan made a good point. We're about back 10 years in some cases on certain home categories. And I think that if a person looks at a home purchase as a place to live, raise a family, historical averages probably 2% per year appreciation value over time. 10 years from now, that home you buy today, even given everything we are going through, is my opinion is going to be worth more than what you paid for today.
Listen to him sell me. Listen to him. He's working me. He's just working me. Ryan, is that a fair assessment that years ago it was painful to get into a house but easy to get out at a higher rate? Now it's just reverse. It's easy to get in, maybe a little more painful to get out, but not impossible.
I think that it was a little too easy to get in the past few years, and that's caused some of the problems. But I do think that Ed's exactly right. You can't look necessarily at your home as an investment that you can just jump out of 2 years from now and make $50,000. I mean, homes, they just don't historically appreciate at those kind of levels. But I do think that since prices have come down as far as they have now, as long as you plan on being in your home for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you're going to do fine. There's no reason to think, barring some catastrophic event happening to the economy, that something that prices are going to continue to drop for years and years now. I mean, I think we're getting pretty close to the bottom. The numbers certainly seem to bear that out.
And before we go, just to both of you, getting back to a more rational, you're buying a house to live in kind of approach to the real estate market, how has that changed your job, Ryan, and then Ed?
Well, I think that it's taken a shift in the mentality on the part of both buyers and sellers to kind of wrap their minds around the idea that you're not going to just buy a home and flip it. You live in it for 2 years and flip it. People are now a little bit more realistic about what is involved in the home buying process, where I think that people were buying with dollar signs in their eyes a few years ago, thinking that there was no risk involved because prices were just going up. I think that you have a more realistic expectations on the part of buyers and sellers.
Ed, does that make for better communities, better neighborhoods, better neighbors?
Absolutely. We're getting back to basics, and people have to put some money into the game. Lenders, the rules have changed. They've gotten back the way they used to be, which is common sense, and I think we're bringing some of that back into the housing market, and that's going to help in the stabilization. I'm not sure in Ryan's area he has this problem, but what has really hurt our values out here are short sales. I don't know if
they're definitely bringing prices down on resale homes.
And this is a product of the change in the IRS code in the fall of 07 when they suspended the debt forgiveness tax. And the feds could do a lot overnight with no cost to the taxpayers if they would eliminate that, because it removed responsibility and actually interferes with contract law that you have in your purchase contract with your lender, the normal foreclosure process and bankruptcy laws. And it's been a terrible thing.
Well, we'll see if they're listening in Washington. We just have a couple seconds. You want to give me your hottest prospect to both of you as you head out today to do what you do every day? Ryan first.
Well, I think that if you're a buyer in the market today, there are some exceptional values on some foreclosed properties that have only been lived in for a couple of years, where you're seeing the values 30% and 40% below what they were 2 and 3 years ago.
Okay, Ed, give me your quick classified.
I just think that you need to put your house in order as far as your finances, talk to a good lender. Make sure you don't buy more house than you can afford. That's what I caution my people.
Well, good advice from Ed Snively of Ed Snively Realty Group in El Centro, California, and Ryan Ward from the Ryan Ward Group in Atlanta. Thanks to both of you, and good luck today. Now, one more broker story. Our own Femi Oke is on assignment this week, and she has the story of Behrouz the Broker, a real estate agent and mortgage lender who saved many of his clients from financial disaster when other brokers were trying to make as much money as possible, selling huge homes that clients could barely afford. Behrouz was taking a more paternal approach.
I feel like you take people who want to buy a house and you say, listen, my daughter, my son, let me give you my advice. And
exactly.
Do you feel that almost that spiritual way of guiding people?
Yes, that's my job, because I got a call one day. This lovely husband and wife from Israel called and they wanted to see a house in neighboring town, Kreskin. And when I met them, I treated them as if they were my children. And at one point, the lady said, I am going to adopt you as my father. I said, God bless you.
Heroes for these economic times. Stories from Femi Oke. You'll hear more from our spiritual real estate broker tomorrow. This morning, we're asking you, who has offered you relief from this recession? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. All on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
question for the president. Achieving Middle East peace, hard or easy?
It's not easier than it was, but I think it's just as necessary.
Exactly 30 years after President Carter helped Israel and Egypt to make peace, Israelis and Palestinians remain locked in a political and military stalemate. Assessing chances for peace as Obama takes a turn on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, March 26th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is out spending time with her new baby. Coming up this hour, we'll talk to North Dakota residents who are working to combat rising waters, and we'll hear about what to expect from Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who will be on Capitol Hill in about an hour. And we'll look at the historic peace treaty brokered between Egypt and Israel 30 years ago today. Those stories coming up at first headlines. How much did the GDP shrink last quarter? The Commerce Department released its third and final estimate this morning, saying it shrank at an annual rate of 6.3%. The first estimate was 6.2%, slightly worse than last month's prediction, but not as bad as economists had expected. There were 652,000 new applicants for unemployment benefits last week. That's a slight rise from the week before. The total number of people claiming benefits is now more than 5.5 million. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner wants to expand his powers so that he can help prevent another economic meltdown.
We need to begin the process, the difficult, careful process of putting in place reforms to help ensure that this country is never again confronted with the untenable choice between catastrophic financial risk and massive taxpayer bailouts.
Coming up, we'll have more on that difficult and careful process going on Capitol Hill to re-regulate the economy. Mark Garrison, what else is out there?
Good morning, John. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Mexico speaking out against drug-related violence. She says the U.S. will work with Mexico to fight it. A day before she arrived, the Obama administration pledged to send more money and manpower to help Mexico battle drug cartels. Clinton will check in with the Mexican authorities today on a visit to a police station in Mexico City. A legendary historian of the black experience in America has died at the age of 94. John Hope Franklin passed away yesterday. He once chaired President Clinton's initiative on race in 1997. Speaking then, he said a government apology to blacks should go beyond the issue of slavery.
Apologizing to slavery will not in itself do it. It's got to be more than that. What are you going to do about all of the examples and practices of degradation and humiliation and segregation that practiced in the 20th century?
Franklin also contributed research that helped the legal team win the Brown versus Board of Education school segregation case.
And he wrote the first history of blacks in America,
which is still used today.
1967,
American history,
still in
courses.
Print. An enormously significant book.
Turning to the economy, IBM plans to eliminate 5,000 U.S. jobs. That's about 4% of its American workforce.
So the Dow and S&P both posted gains yesterday, and trading begins in about a half an hour. The S&P kicks off at 8:14, and futures are actually happy about the economic numbers Mark was talking about. It looks like a positive opening in 30 minutes. We're asking for your recession hero stories. The boss who took a pay cut to avoid layoffs, or who offered more flexibility rather than laying people off. Femi Okeh is out on assignment looking for people who are stemming the flood of the recession, sandbaggers in this recession. We're going to be talking about those kinds of stories later on in the week, but we want to hear yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We've noted on this program a few times that among the regions of the United States spared the worst of the economic crisis is North Dakota and the Northern Prairie. But that region has not been spared the ravages of the spring thaw. It's taking place right now, and flooding in Fargo, North Dakota, on the Red River is expected to crest at a record 41 feet above flood stage this Saturday. Sarah Mayo joins us now. She's a junior political science major at North Dakota State University. Sarah, you've been doing some sandbagging?
Lots of sandbagging.
Getting any college credit for that?
Well, not that I've been told so far.
Well, explain to me what it is that you've been doing and who have you met in your community as part of this community-wide effort to really save Fargo from an impending disaster. The president has declared your state a disaster area.
Yeah. At our campus, NDSU, we have the Fargo Dome, and that's kind of the headquarters for filling sandbags. I've been there 2 days now. We're just shoveling sand into these bags and loading them onto trucks to go to the dikes. As far as people I've met, it seems like everyone in Fargo is either there or on the dikes piling the bags or doing something else to help. Like, there's 6-7-year-old kids who are tying the bags for us. There's something they can do to help. There's little old ladies who are bringing food to the dome to fill hungry workers. We've got even I've seen people with developmental disabilities even delivering bottles of water to thirsty workers. And yesterday I met a blind guy who was sitting on an overturned bucket and his wife was shoveling sand into the bags he was holding for her.
Well, Sarah, those are great pictures. And it's really a political story. I mean, you don't get this kind of turnout for voting in Fargo, I would think.
Yeah, I don't know what our turnout for voting is, but I know it's not everyone in the city, just like all who's helping out the flood here.
What do you think this has taught you about the potential for communities to hang together in times that are stressful, whether they're involving geologic disasters like the flooding or not?
It's so touching to see how everyone is coming together, and not only people from our community, but actually I was looking online this morning and I saw some Craigslist postings in Minneapolis, St. Paul. There was one person who said that he had been laid off from his job. He was unemployed. He didn't have any money to drive into Fargo, but he had plenty of time to donate to our cause, and he wanted to find a ride with someone who's coming to Fargo so he could help sandbag.
It seems there's a real hunger out there on the prairie to get together and really solve this. First of all, what are they telling you as far as your ability to resist the worst of the damage that could happen if the flooding really gets out of control?
Well, I just listened to Mayor Wallaker on the news last night. He was telling us that we have about a 3-to-1 chance that all our dikes will hold and we'll save everything we're trying to save right now. There is a plan, I guess, to put in secondary dikes, which will save the city infrastructure if the primary dikes break. Although he noted that we also had that in 97 and the primary dikes didn't break at that time, so we didn't even need the secondary dikes, and we're just hoping that'll happen again this time.
All right, well, we're hoping with you. It sounds like at the very least, Sarah Mayo, there needs to be a new movie called Fargo to update that nasty movie that came out several years ago.
My friends and I were just talking about that yesterday, actually, because a new movie like that would show the really good side of Fargo.
All right, Sarah Mayo, with a tip of the hat to the Coen brothers. Sarah Mayo is a junior political science major at North Dakota State University, one of the record sandbaggers at the Fargo Dome who bagged 500,000 sandbags one day this week. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for having me on to talk about Fargo, John.
So we're going to shift gears at this point. It is... I just love her. She's the best. So it's certainly no surprise to imagine, and think about this now, that former Vice President Dick Cheney is a bit of a skeptic about the Obama administration.
Now he's making some choices that, in my mind, will in fact raise the risk to the American people of another attack.
Dick Cheney talking about choices that President Obama has made on a wide range of issues in one of the interviews that he's done since the election. Since 2001, half of all FBI agents have been assigned to uncovering terrorist attacks in the U.S., and it was unclear how the Obama administration might actually change that focus. But Attorney General Eric Holder is now saying that the FBI will keep counterterrorism as its top priority, even in the face of mortgage fraud and the deadly drug war on the Mexican border. This comes in a report today in the New York Times that was co-written by David Johnston, who joins us now from Washington, D.C. David, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
This seems to be a really important story that I think could conceivably get lost in the sauce with all the other news that's going on. Explain why Americans should really be concerned about this maintaining the focus on counterterrorism in both the FBI and the Department of Justice.
Well, what you have is that basically looking at the FBI, an agency that has
two main functions. One is traditional law enforcement, sort of the usual cops and robbers chasing bad guys and kidnappers and drug dealers. The other half of the FBI deals with counterterrorism and counterespionage, chasing spies. And after 9/11, when the FBI came under heavy criticism for failing to detect the plot, the FBI moved thousands of agents, nearly 2,000 agents, from the criminal side over to this counterterrorism side, and it has kept them there. Over those years, there have been some people who have said, we have a better handle on the threat, and it's at a level that we can handle without that many agents. But the fear and the political fear from based on comments like those from former Vice President Cheney is that that they have not been willing or able to move agents back into the criminal side. And now, with a very loud furor of about the need for more resources on the southern border and to cope with the economic collapse, the pressure is really on the Justice Department and on the FBI and on the Obama administration to try to correct that balance.
Is there a fundamental incompatibility with the skill set of prevention in a counterterrorism mission versus evidence gathering in a criminal prosecution mission?
Well, the FBI will say no, that basically going out, hitting the streets and getting information is the same to combat a La Cosa Nostra case, or as it would be in trying to ferret out what's going on with Al-Qaeda in the United States. There are others who say that the level of knowledge, the kind of language skills, the understanding of kind of culture and demographics is very different. But so it may not be the agents are not perhaps as fungible as those who are managing them would like to think.
You know, is this partly what your story is about, the outline of a potential clash between the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security on this issue of how to defend America from another terrorist attack?
I think what you're seeing is that the Justice Department, which is the agency that supervises the FBI, would, in a sense, like to leave the border enforcement issues to Homeland Security, and Homeland, to some degree, would be willing and happy to have that mission. But I think the clamor to send in all resources in the government is becoming so intense that the FBI can't escape demands, and the Justice Department can't escape the pressure to come in and do something about this problem. It's, after all, the FBI is the country's best-known law enforcement agency, and when there's a criminal justice problem, it always is under pressure to do something about it.
David Johnston, if I put my cynic hat on, which most listeners say I never take off anyway, how are we to evaluate whether this is Eric Holder grabbing the sexiest issue, the counterterrorism issue, to maintain the visibility and profile in the bureaucracy of his agency?
Well, I think what you're seeing is a new attorney general coming in and really getting his sort of feet wet in all of the problems that he's confronting. Eric Holder is no stranger to the Justice Department. He was the deputy attorney general, and he's been a prosecutor for many years. His period prior to this at the Justice Department was largely in a period when counterterrorism was not nearly as large an issue as it is today. He is really, I think, far more comfortable in a traditional law enforcement prosecutorial kind of role. So he's feeling his way along here. What I think you're seeing is more a political concern that the Justice Department does not want to seem, or they don't want to be accused of being weak.
Well, the political evolution of Attorney General Eric Holder. It's a great story. Pick up the New York Times and read it. David Johnston, New York Times Justice Department correspondent. We thank him for being with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Regulation could have saved us. That's what some economists say about the high-risk boom times of the last decade. Regulation could have helped us avoid this economic downturn. Well, today, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner heads to Capitol Hill once again to outline his sweeping overhaul of federal financial regulations. How did he characterize the word regulation earlier this week?
Enormous damage has been done as a consequence of a long period of excess risk-taking without meaningful adult supervision.
Excess risk-taking without meaningful adult supervision. Well, does this new plan amount to meaningful adult supervision? Here to talk about it are Philip Coggan, capital markets editor at The Economist, and Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek and columnist for Slate. Dan and Philip, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me just characterize what I think these regulations are about, and you can tell me if I'm, or shoot me full of holes if you like. It seems like they're enlarging the range of regulations, treating banks and insurance companies and other securities agencies the same rather than having them in a patchwork quilt of regulations. And finally, it seems as though this is a way of preventing the too big to fail proliferation of giant companies like AIG. Is that a fair characterization?
I don't think it's quite fair enough. I mean, let's start by saying banks have been regulated a lot, and they have been at the heart of this crisis. So regulation isn't a cure-all. I think there is a sensible point in here, which is that the regulation has been too patchwork. You've got the SEC, you've got the Fed, you've got the CFTC, which is a Commodity Futures Trading Corporation in Chicago. You've got the FDIC, which guarantees bank. There's too many of these regulators, and bringing regulation more centralized, having somebody knowing what's going on, that's sensible. They're also trying to expand it to cover hedge funds, private equity, and that may sound very plausible, but I worry a bit that they're pursuing these sort of side issues and not really focusing on what needs to be done.
Dan Gross, extension of regulation has historically meant that the financial sector moves into a new zone of zero regulation. How can Geithner's new plan prevent that from happening?
There's always a degree to which we regulate against the last debacle. You know, after 2002, when there was a lot of accounting problems, we passed Sarbanes-Oxley, making CEOs and CFOs sign on the dotted line. We haven't had much accounting fraud. So there's by necessity, it's like we're always fighting the last regulatory war, trying to stop the last bubble from happening again. And, of course, a new bubble, they always find a way to create something new. I think I would disagree with Philip on one thing. The regulated commercial banking system is not where the heart of the problems were. It was in the unregulated shadow banking system. And by that I mean we had a whole set of institutions, hedge funds, private equity, investment banks, insurance companies that started to do the sorts of things that banks do and on a similar scale, but were largely unregulated.
Well, let's talk for a minute about what the trigger would be to come under this regulatory environment that Geithner envisions here. If I'm a hedge fund and I create a security from bundling a couple of mortgages together and maybe some bonds and something or other, and I call it a John Hockenberry note, do I suddenly, under this law, become regulated by some Geithner agency, Philip Coggan?
Well, the rules aren't clear because there's nothing on the Treasury website at the moment. We're only going on wire reports. But if you're big enough and you're judged to be a threat to the system, yes, then you would start to be regulated that way. But I just want to come back on the point you made. The hedge funds don't bundle up securities and create these structured products. It's been the banks that have done that. The hedge funds have bought some of them, certainly, and they bought them by borrowing money from the banks. But to go back to Dan's point, unfortunately, it was that the banks owned a lot of these securities on their balance sheets that has completely threaten the security of these institutions. And again, those banks were regulated. The hedge funds were kind of conspirators in this whole system. But if the banks hadn't been stuck with the securities, if they passed them all off to the hedge funds, as was supposedly happening in theory, then we wouldn't have the problems we have now. It's been the fact that banks have ended up with too much of this and basically have become insolvent.
Dan Gross, what if I just declared myself a public company and rather than buying a mortgage, I just sold stock in myself and that's how I bought a house? Would I be regulated by Timothy Geithner?
Well, if you want to sell stock to the public, you have to register with the SEC. A lot of people are already, you know, the hedge funds do have to file certain documents with the SEC declaring what their holdings are every quarter. So there is some regulation of this going on. I think what we're talking about is, and again, this is very complicated, and we're not sure how it's going to work, because what we've seen in the last decade is that people can come out of nowhere and pose systemic risk. Long-term capital management back in 1998, I don't think prior to its blowing up and causing a bailout in the billions at the time, anybody would have said that this firm is too big to create a systemic problem. It's not necessarily your absolute size in terms of assets. It's the level of recklessness and stupidity with which you use, you know, your balance sheet. And again, I'm not sure how we regulate that.
Well, and long-term capital management went from being a totally obscure fund to being Alan Greenspan, the Fed chairman's like biggest deal back when it failed. More details as Timothy Geithner heads to Capitol Hill today to outline the details of this regulatory scheme. Thanks for helping us figure it out. Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek and columnist for Slate, and Philip Coggin, capital markets editor at The Economist. Now, Mark Garrison with some more headlines.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 28 minutes after the hour. Speaking of Tim Geithner and all you've been talking about in the last segment, new economic numbers are just out last hour. The economy shrank at an annual rate of 6.3% in the fourth quarter of last year. The revised GDP figure is a bit worse than the Commerce Department said earlier. Also, a separate report shows there were 652,000 new applications for unemployment benefits. That is a slight jump from the previous week. Speaking of jobs, IBM is cutting 5,000 of them in the U.S. That's about 4% of that company's total American workforce. President Obama's 2010 budget has cleared one hurdle, but there's a long road ahead with many changes possible. The House Budget Committee approved a version of it on party lines last night, but that's only a rough blueprint. Expect lots of fighting over the details later in the House and the Senate. Republicans like New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg are critical.
It loads a massive amounts of debt, massive amounts of new taxes onto our children's backs.
We'll watch that. It's being taken up in the Senate today. An Air Force F-22 Raptor has crashed in Southern California, killing the pilot. That is the military's most advanced and expensive fighter. They run about $140 million apiece. The cause is now under investigation. A new report by the National Federation of the Blind says only 10% of blind Americans can read Braille, and very few children are learning it. The group's president, Mark Maurer, is worried.
It is important for children to learn Braille because if they don't, they will be much less able to perform in the workplace, and they won't be able to get as good an education.
Eckert Support blames schools for relying on recordings and audio tests, voice recognition, instead of teaching Braille to children.
Another sort of manifestation of the Internet era, a consequence
it's
of the Internet
very true.
Era. Yeah, indeed. Thanks, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Back at the end of February, President Obama, at his Fiscal Health of the Nation Summit at the White House, had this to say about Virginia Congressman Republican Eric Cantor, who's also the Republican whip in the House.
I'm going to keep on talking to Eric Cantor someday, sooner or later.
He's going to say, boy, Obama had a good idea. It's going to happen. You watch.
Congressman Eric Cantor from Virginia. Any sign Barack Obama has a good idea yet?
Well, good morning. Yeah, you know, the difficulty, I think, for all of us right now is trying to figure out a way forward to see how we bring this economy back and to make sure that people can get back to work and we can see growth and prosperity again. So I don't have any difference in the fact that we all want this economy to work. It's just how we get there. And this week we are beginning the budget process in earnest in Washington. What we see is a budget that has been presented by the administration that, frankly, is so far out of the mainstream that we're going to work very hard as House Republicans to try and pull that budget back into the mainstream, try and reduce the level of spending so that we are not piling trillions of dollars of debt onto the backs of our children.
All right. The deficit, of course, was an issue throughout the Bush administration as well. As the president has noted, the numbers are much, much higher here. But I'm wondering if there's a certain amount of discredited economic theory in the Republicans claiming that it's more efficient to have tax cuts to stimulate the economy and that deficits will only drive economic growth downward. I mean, the federal government and the state governments and the public sector is the only sector hiring at this point in the economy. Congressman?
Well, first of all, I don't think it is helpful to go back and point fingers. Could we have done better? Could the Bush administration have done better? The Republican-held Congress? Absolutely. But we need to go forward because we need to solve the problems right here and now. And I don't know how anyone can think that if you look at where we are economically in this country and the fact that we have a tremendous amount of debt, we are in a hole. How do you say we're going to get out of that by digging that hole deeper?
Well, let's look at it from a congressman.
That's really what's going on.
I hear that argument, but let's look at it from the perspective of the grandkids that the Republicans are talking about consistently as being on the hook. I mean, first of all, they were on the hook with the deficits during the last 8 years. But, you know, from the standpoint of those grandchildren, is it more important to worry about their debt, when they become adults, or is it more important to get their fathers and grandfathers and mothers jobs?
Right now, you're right. We've got to worry about getting food on the table. But if you look at this budget, how do you get food on the table by saying that you're going to impose a national energy tax on every household in this country when households, when mothers and fathers and grandparents are having difficulty making their mortgage payments and paying their bills? The Obama administration is proposing a huge, huge energy tax for every household in this country. The estimates are from the MIT economists that over 3,000 $1,000 a year will be the tax that every household pays on
right.
this utility
Congressman,
bill,
let's
gas
talk,
bill,
right.
anything that people purchase that are manufactured in this country.
But Congressman, the MIT scientists,
the
MIT economists don't use the word tax in describing the cap and trade system, which is a more subtle way of paying for carbon emissions as a way of dealing with climate issues that there is a mainstream consensus on dealing with. They don't call it a tax up at MIT, I don't think.
Well, you call it what you will. If you're going to have to pay a 50% higher utility bill, I call that a tax. And right now, we ought to be very much focused on how we get jobs created again. You mentioned that it's the government that is hiring. Frankly, increasing government spending at best redistributes wealth. We ought to be about creating wealth, creating jobs. And the way we do
that in a recession, Congressman,
we help small business people and give them relief because they're the ones that create 70% of the jobs in this country.
I've heard that over and over again. What infuriates me about that, and again, I'm not a supporter of Barack Obama per se. It just seems to me that in a recession, small businesses aren't hiring. It's the private, public sector that hires. You give small business relief, they're going
to
put the money in the bank.
To give you an example of some of the, if you want to give the public sector money, to give you the example of the stimulus bill that recently passed through the Nancy Pelosi-controlled House and was signed into law by the president, the almost $800 billion bill. To give you just an example, $3 million went to the District of Columbia. You know what they did with that money? They're going to go build bike paths, and they're going to increase the number of bike racks in neighborhoods like Georgetown. I don't think that that's a stimulative move. What we need
if you were working on the construction crew that made those bike paths, you'd think it was stimulus, wouldn't you?
We need to create lasting jobs, and that's how we create wealth, and that's how people can get some confidence back. If they know that the jobs and the economy are going to start growing again, you don't grow the economy by only stimulating the public sector spending. We've seen that over and again. History has borne out in the 70s in the UK, in France in the 80s. We don't want to go towards a European model of socializing everything. What we want to do is grow the private sector, get the entrepreneurs and the small businesses back into the game, because in the end, they're the ones that create 70% of the jobs in this
country. Okay, well, you know, getting the debate out of the 70s and 80s in France, I think, is probably useful. And I'm hitting you pretty hard here, but before we go, let me just ask you this question. What do you say to the people who have charged, and, you know, you can hear it on cable news every night, that some members of the GOP are just basically sitting out this crisis and hoping that bad news in 2 years is going to help elect members of the opposition party?
That is so far from the truth and absolutely untrue. And you know, even the president has said that the GOP has no ideas, we're rejectionists. He knows better than that. I personally handed Barack Obama our plan on the stimulus. We will unveil our budget plan throughout this process this week and next in Washington. We will have a plan on energy. We will have a plan on health care. We are committed to being a constructive voice in Congress that's going to reflect the mainstream in this country. The important thing to remember is we cannot go and spend our kids' future. You know, if you look at this budget, it doubles the amount of debt for every man, woman, and child.
I know the numbers. I know the numbers.
It increases from $35,000 to $70,000 per man, woman, and child.
Congressman,
who's going to pay for that? Our kids are. That's why we have got to work very hard to pull this budget back into the mainstream.
Congressman, Politico is making much of the fact that you showed up at the Britney Spears concert on Tuesday night. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, listen, we were, you know, I don't know why that is an issue whatsoever. There was a concert, and I had a political event at that concert. You know, look, that is why I was there. So, I mean, I don't see how
I wouldn't feel bad about it. I mean, I don't know. Your daughter's probably be thrilled if you had any.
I think my daughter really was mad that she wasn't there.
All right. Thank you. Congressman Eric Cantor is the Republican whip in the House, giving us a taste of the tough GOP debate between Democrats and Republicans over the budget.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Rumblings, rumblings, rumblings under the earth in the stressed real estate market in California, but it's geology, not economics, we're going to talk about. Joining us is Leonardo Sieber, who's senior research scientist at Columbia University. He's on the line from New Paltz, New York. A magnitude 4.8 earthquake shook the foot of the San Andreas Fault on Tuesday after a bunch of very small earthquakes over the weekend. What's the significance of this and the fact that it's at the very famous San Andreas Fault, I suspect, is meaningful here. Professor?
Yes, of course. The San Andreas Fault has not been the site of a big earthquake for some time, so it's loaded to rupture, particularly in that area in the south. And so earthquakes that occur near the faults are quite significant.
Now, when you say loaded, you mean it's like a spring. It's wound up because of movement of the earth that eventually an earthquake will unload that spring, and that's what happens in a major earthquake, the so-called big one in California. Are we closer to that?
Yes, that sounds like a good description. The plates move with respect to each other. The Pacific plate is moving to the northwest relative to North America. And, of course, these big plates don't care exactly what's happening along the plate boundary. So when the faults are locked, during most of the time, the motion is absorbed elastically around the fault. And then when the fault ruptures and it reaches the breaking point, then the fault will move for some number of feet. And when that happens, all this elastic energy is released. It goes into seismic waves that propagate away from the fault, and sometimes they do damage.
Now, you sound very sort of aware of the forces at work here. What is it that we're not seeing as seismologists that makes it so difficult to predict a big event, especially if there's so much activity that we can detect?
Because you're looking at a process where the stress is going up slowly, slowly, and at some point it will break. And the point of breaking depends on many, many factors. And, of course, the point of breaking is not known exactly. It can be many different places along the fault where the breaking starts. Once the breaking starts, it propagates down the fault, and the further it propagates, the bigger is going to be the earthquake. And so that's what makes it difficult to predict.
Now, you know, it seems to me I hear about the San Andreas Fault all the time, every time there's any seismic activity in California. But is it the case that the San Andreas Fault has not really busted loose for 300 years?
A portion of the fault near the Salton Sea up to San Gorgonio Pass, that's what it is. It hasn't ruptured in 300 years. And it moves an inch and a half or two per year. And so you can calculate how much is going to move in the big earthquake.
So an inch and a half per year times 300 years,
yeah,
that's,
you know,
oh, my goodness.
Right. It's about 3 centimeters or whatever that is.
Don't like doing that math. But Leonardo Sieber, that's something to contemplate this morning. Senior research scientist at Columbia University talking about the San Andreas Fault moving.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Coming up, the window of opportunity for Middle East peace 30 years after Camp David. But first, Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, the city of Fargo, North Dakota is calling for thousands more volunteers to add sandbags to fight off flooding. This as the Red River rises higher than predicted. In the middle of the state, the Missouri River threatens. And tornado damage ripped through southern Mississippi overnight. Severe weather damaged dozens of buildings. No fatalities reported, but injuries still unknown. Also in about 10 minutes, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will testify in the House, expected to call for legislation to give greater power for the federal government over financial institutions.
And the economy shrank a bit more in the final quarter of the year, and unemployment claims up a little bit.
You bet.
Thank you, Mark Garrison. So did you hear the last question in Barack Obama's news conference earlier this week?
Mr. President, you came to office pledging to work for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. How realistic do you think those hopes are now, given the likelihood of a prime minister who is not fully signed up to a two-state solution and a foreign minister who has been accused of insulting Arabs?
It's not easier than it was, but I think it's just as necessary.
You know, in other presidencies, that question would probably have come closer to the beginning of the news conference. 30 years after Camp David, 30 years to the day after the Camp David process that brought peace between Israel and Egypt, we are thrilled to have former U.S. Ambassador to Israel and Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs during the Clinton administration, Martin Indyk, to join us. He's currently the director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He has a new book out, Innocent Abroad, an intimate account of American peace diplomacy in the Middle East. Ambassador Indyk, thanks for being with us.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be with you.
Well, let's talk first of all about the Barack Obama response to that question about the Benjamin Netanyahu government, which hasn't been fully formed yet. It's not clear if it's going to be a fully right-wing coalition or a right-wing center coalition. What do you make of Barack Obama's answer? And is it the case that it's not easier with Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister in Israel?
Well, the response was hardly what you'd call a warm embrace of the prospective new partners in peacemaking, and I think raised some eyebrows in amongst pro-Israelis around town. But he went on to say something which I think is also very important. He used it, in a sense, as an indicator of his whole approach to all of the problems that he faces now, which is persistence. He kept on saying, what I believe in is persisting even though it's not clear how we can succeed. And I think he's exactly right in that regard. The new government in formation in Israel is going to be not a narrow right-wing government, which is what it looked like it would be for the last month or so, but rather one that also includes the Labour Party. And Ehud Barak, former Prime Minister and former competitor to Bibi Netanyahu, will be his partner as Defence Minister. And this gives the government a more stable coalition, a more balanced coalition. And it's possible, we'll have to see, that Bibi in his reincarnation as a second Prime Minister will decide that his legacy should be this time bringing Israel to peace.
And many traditional right-wingers in Israel have come to that conclusion, including Ariel Sharon, Menachem Begin, that essentially the legacy has to be peace, not a narrow, more right-wing approach. Let's talk a little bit about your book. One of the reasons it's been given, I think, amazing reviews and why I enjoyed it so much is it's not preachy. It's not sort of, saying what should be the solution. It is a real sort of accounting of what is important in solid diplomacy. And in characterizing the Clinton administration, it seems to me you've told the story of how important it is for leaders to recognize what is hard in negotiations and what is easy, and that Bill Clinton, in a sense, got that terribly wrong.
Well, he got one thing terribly right, which brings me back to Obama's point. He believed strongly that it was better to try, even if you fail, than not to try at all. And the problem with George W. Bush was that he believed the opposite, that it was better not to try at all than to try and fail. And he only came around to it in his last year. And then it was even harder. Clinton, I think, thought that, and I was with him in this, I was advising him on this at the beginning of the administration, that there was a wide window that had opened of opportunity to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. And we, that's why I called it innocent abroad, because we kind of sallied forth into the bazaars of the Middle East believing that we could actually resolve these conflicts. And it's the wonderful thing about Americans that we think, you know, we can do this. But the innocence, the lack of understanding that this is immensely complicated, and you're dealing with undercurrents and cross currents. Things are interconnected in ways that we don't really understand. We can't read the minds of authoritarian leaders, and we find ourselves soon sucked down into the swamps of the region and find it very difficult to get out there.
Well, you know, the lesson that George W. Bush drew from the experience of the Clinton administration was it's better not to try. But I'm wondering if maybe one of the lessons from your book is it would have been better if we had tried harder. In both the case of Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak, who were principals during the Clinton administration, it seemed in the end they feared to go forward, a fear that might have been diminished if Bill Clinton or you had pushed harder.
Yes, but it's hard. It's always easier in retrospect. I think in the case with Barak, we really had an opportunity to have a breakthrough to peace with Syria, and Barak was ready to make the deal, make the offer of full withdrawal from the Golan, but he just felt that he needed to negotiate a bit longer to show his public that he was being a tough negotiator. And the timing was critically important. And And Clinton tried to move Barack, but he failed. And I think at that moment, actually, counterintuitively, he would have been much better closing his folder and telling Barack, listen, I can't do anything more for you.
Calling a bluff.
Exactly.
Right.
And just kind of saying, you know, that's it. If you can't do the deal now, then I can't help you.
Well, it's a very different window today, as Barack Obama suggested in his news conference. So what do you make of Israel's sense of isolation going into this new government, something that's been talked about in The New York Times repeatedly, and we've mentioned it on this program, and also the state of political chaos within the Palestinian movement?
Well, I think that Israel's isolation is too much is made of that. I think that Israel finds itself with strong relationships, not only with the United States, but with Europe, with Russia, with China, with Japan. You know, it's a very different kind of Israel today. Israel's big problem is that it's fighting an asymmetric war with Hezbollah and Hamas and other terrorist organizations, and the defense capabilities that it's built up over the years with our assistance do not work effectively in these circumstances. And it has not yet developed an effective strategy for dealing with these Iranian-backed challenges. And then, of course, it faces the problem of nuclear Iran, an Iran that's heading seemingly in leaps and bounds towards acquiring nuclear weapons.
Would you advise direct talks with Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah, or any of the above?
No, I think, you know, it's a complicated answer to a simple question. But I think that the Israelis do understand that it's important for Obama to try to head off Iran's nuclear program through diplomacy. And they seem to be prepared to give that a chance. I suspect that if Netanyahu, when he comes to Washington, can feel reassured from Obama on the issue of the existential threat from Iran, that he will be willing in exchange to be more flexible and more forward-leaning when it comes to dealing with the Palestinians.
We will have to watch. That was Martin Indyk, former U.S. Ambassador to Israel and Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs during the Clinton administration. His new book is called Innocent Abroad, an intimate account of American peace diplomacy in the Middle East. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. You know that. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And your takeaway?
It's like we're always fighting the last regulatory war, trying to stop the last bubble from happening again. And, of course, they always find a way to create something new.
That's Dan Gross waiting for the next financial bubble and assessing the new ideas of regulation that Timothy Geithner is talking about on Capitol Hill at this hour. Dan Gross, of course, is a senior editor at Newsweek and a Slate columnist. Tune in next time on The Takeaway. Femi Okeh is going to be back from her reporting assignment, finding heroes of this recession, people sandbagging along the river of economic woe in the United States. Tune in for those stories and send your own, won't you, at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.